Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale. I work here at UBS, financial advisor within the Soteria Wealth Management team here at UBS Financial Services here in New York City. This is our very first podcast, and I'm extremely thrilled with our very first guest. I want to preface everything by saying the theme for these podcasts, at least over the course of the next several months, will be about the $148 trillion that is about to change hands between now and 2045. The primary beneficiary of that to start will be women. So the focus, I think, for me over the next several months will be women's health in not just financial health, but also women's well-being. They will become the primary beneficiaries of this transfer of wealth. And I think it's incredibly important that we as a society start to focus more and more on that. You can reach me at michael.pasquale, P-A-S-Q-U-A-L-E, at ubs.com. And as I mentioned, I'm very pleased today with my first guest. So I'll be joined today by Sophie Chi, a Tony and Olivier Award-winning cultural entrepreneur and the CEO of Harmonia Holdings. Please note, Sophie is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc., and her views are on her own. In this episode, we'll be exploring the theme of women's wealth and well-being as we uncover Sophie's remarkable journey from finance to the arts, her innovative strategies for building wealth through creativity, and how she is transforming global investment by uniting cultures on the world's most iconic stages. I'm very blessed to call her a friend and extremely pleased to formally introduce Sophie Chi as my very first guest in my podcast. Sophie, thank you and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I always admire what UBS has stand for, which is helping people think for long term and live with purpose. It's my great honor to be your first guest.
Thank you. So if it's okay, Sophie, why don't we get started right away with a little bit of questions around your journey, what you're planning on doing going forward, things you've learned, and we'll get started. So my first question is, can you take us back to the beginning? Now, for somebody like me, that would take a long time because that would have been a long time ago. What first drew you to the arts and how did that passion evolve into a career?
That's a great question. I have been asked that question many times because, as you know, in both financial world and Broadway entertainment world, women, especially as a female and Asian woman, often to be like one of the only sitting there. So, you know, if I look back my life right now, it has falls in two chapters, before New York City and after New York City. I grown up in a capital city along the Yellow River Valley. There is vast, beautiful, traditional regional operas in China. My father was engineer who loves opera, especially particularly this regional opera from his hometown called Huangmei Xi. And he also loves literatures. And so I grew up like listen to those traditional operas and also world-class literatures that was translated into Chinese. So as a young age, I was always amazed how the stories that written centuries ago can travel across culture and time. After I moved to New York City, I often joke that I moved to New York City last century, which is 1999. I came over for MBA study with, back then I barely speak English and I had no connections, but I do have a heart full of dreams. And New York City definitely cracked me open and taught me a lot of things that I thought I knew. So the city basically inspired me to dream even bigger. And then I discovered Broadway, everything aligned, because I realized the theater sits in the middle in everything I was built for. And something I realized how undervalued the global arts ecosystem is, not creatively, but structurally. So that insight became the foundation of Harmonia.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you. Your journey is just such an inspiration to so many people. And I'm very excited to continue to talk about what you've done and what you've accomplished and talk about what's going on a go-forward basis. Now, Sophie, you've talked, even with me, you've talked about that quote-unquote special sauce. So I guess that's sort of like a gut feeling when you know someone or something is going to be super special and maybe be economically viable situation, but more importantly, maybe a cultural situation that's really going to resonate with audiences. Can you talk about how that plays a role in your decision-making and, you know, maybe an example or two where, you know, maybe if you had one where you didn't have that and it still succeeded, or maybe it didn't, or how do you, you know, sort of, you know, talk about that special sauce?
People often think intuition is magic, but a real institution is just decades of pattern recognition. If there's special sauce that I am proud of have, it's when a story moves me emotionally and has a structure to scale across markets. So I trust my instincts because they are shaped by a lifetime between East and West. But we always pair intuition with discipline. So clear criteria, market mapping, comparables, and guidance from my advisory board in storytelling and finance. We're not chasing hype. We're looking for truth, stories that could travel and last. Intuition helps me see what others miss. Discipline turns that intuition into asset class. And my organization exists exactly at that intersection.
What a great answer. By the way, I love that quote. I think I may use it. We're not looking for hype. We're looking for truth. And if you can marry the truth with also an economic impact as well, I mean, wow, that's sort of my secret sauce.
It will come over, along, pay attention and really observe, you know.
Yeah, that's great. It's a fabulous quote. So if you wear a lot of hats, whether that's producer, entrepreneur, board member, mother, educator, when you think about your time, how do you manage your time? And then if okay with you, in a financial sense, how do you manage that as well in terms of your priorities, your time? How are you managing your time and financial priorities, you know, through the course of a day, a week, a month, et cetera, given all those hats that you're wearing?
I do have many titles, but the one of them I'm most proud of is a mother. I raised the two boys. You know, as a parent, you know, after you survive, it's all about, you learn the efficiency, right? Crisis management and negotiation skills with probably the most unreasonable people, but all with love.
That's great.
After you survive the sleepless night, you know, the logistic of, you know, carpooling and everything else like budget or, you know, that don't scare you anymore. I don't believe in balance. I believe in integration. I see myself, my life, and my company as an ecosystem. Honestly, it's also because I think I'm very clear about what deserves my time and what deserves my attention. I organize my life around three pillars: purpose, energy, and structure. The purpose is the filter. If something doesn't align with my long-term mission, which is building culture IP as a global multi-generation asset class, it doesn't go on my calendar. Energy is my most valuable currency. I invest where I have the highest impact, nurturing artists, shaping IP strategy, building cross-border partnerships, and working with families and the intuitions who think generationally. Everything else is handled by my strong teams and partners. Of course, like I said, motherhood taught me most of the skill. And I often joke that if you can raise two boys, we're building a company. So, you know, I think you can deal with any artistic team on the earth. Structures keeps everything disciplined. We do have an awesome advisory board, deal frameworks, budgeting, and also we have professional financial institutions such as UBS to help us with asset management. That allows me to focus what only I can do: vision, relationships, and the curation. I don't believe in balance. Once again, I believe in integration. And that's what keeps Harmonia clear, creative, and financially grounded.
Great answer. I love this next question that I have for you, because one of the first things when we met many months ago and we were talking about the industry, my favorite quote, you're probably going to remember this, was when you said, hope is not a strategy. And I believe we're talking about mostly New York theater and the difficulties that it is to turn a profit in an idea. And you said that, and I thought, wow, that is really, really unique. I think from people in the arts, because they are so creative and they are so deep in their business that sometimes they forget about the economic return. So when you think about hope as a strategy that you don't necessarily pursue, you know, what is the strategy that you think about when making financial decisions then? Because if it's not hope, what is it going to be?
Hope is a beautiful emotion, but it's a terrible financial strategy. So, because I came from finance and business background, because before, when I was younger, for a long time, I thought I would be a journalist or writers. But, you know, life took me, you know, into business first. I was in the international trading business, and I was a financial advisor, and I also was into luxury leisure. All that experience taught me the budgeting and discipline and strategy. So I stepped into storytelling field, and I realized that emotion and evaluation are so important. I might fall in love with a story, but love doesn't green light a project. So everything goes through acquisition criteria on comparables, market mapping, global scalability, and the real risk curves. We model multiple scenarios, stress test assumptions, and make sure we can survive the downside while earning the upside. Lastly, you know, I still trust my intuition, but I act on evidence, data, advisors, and cross-border partners who help us verify every decision. I think most importantly, we think in decades, not cycles. Cultural IP behaves like a luxury asset. It's slow, global, and compounding. So long horizon clarity keeps us disciplined. So my rules is very simple. Hope is for the audience. Rigor is for the producer. So inspiration starts the conversations, but numbers make the decision.
That's great. That's great. You know, I think it's a really interesting segue to what I was thinking next in terms of, can you share a moment with me when it didn't work, when something financially didn't pay off? Maybe you kind of knew in your gut it wasn't going to work, or maybe it was one in your gut that you thought this was going to work and the data showed that it was going to work, but it didn't. And what did you learn from that? And how were you able to parlay those losses into, you know, future gains?
Well, I always like to talk something good first, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
So call me optimist. Okay. Actually, one of the biggest financial risks I ever took was my very early investment in Moulin Rouge. And that one definitely paid off. I was still finding my footing as a producer back then. The budget was enormous, and the expectation was very high. And no one knew whether Broadway could truly function as a global IP engine, but something in me recognized both its emotional truth and the message really resonates with me, which is beauty, love, freedom, and truth. But I also look at its commercial structure, which makes most sense as, you know, a person who has a business background. So I trusted my instinct, did the analysis, and stepped in. And today, the show has sold over 8 million tickets worldwide, with a Broadway gross of more than $336 million, I believe. And the productions across Europe, Asia, and the West End I think there are total non-productions are on the market globally.
Wow. And is that currently there's 9 productions?
Yep.
Wow.
Yes. And our most profitable production is the World Tour.
Really?
Yes.
Why so is that?
That's really taught me emotional resonance and the strong architecture align. Risk becomes strategy. I've always taken, but of course, I also, let's talk about something didn't work.
Yeah. Didn't fail. That one won. That was a grand slam. So what about one that didn't work? And maybe for the audience and for me, what lesson did you learn from that? You know, I don't want to say failure because I firmly believe every mistake or every failure is not. It's actually a learning experience. But in that sense, economically, if it wasn't the return that you and maybe your investors expected, what was it that you took away as the biggest example as to maybe why? And what did you learn?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, I see everything is all relevant and the timing is so important. What I learned from this one, this failed, or you called, you know, it didn't pay off right away yet, which I still believe has a huge potential in APAC market. It's another title called King Kong. And so it looks great on the papers. You know, the review was good and everything looks like a great investment. And for me, I truly believe the IP, the title, the story is going to be huge in the global market. Unfortunately, it went down to the wrong market timing. So that experience showed me that the creative merit matters, but the market readiness matters just as much. So we design around risk with a framework, scenario planning, and cross-market discipline. Risk itself isn't an enemy. Mm-hmm. And exam the risk is.
Yeah.
So the best decisions always happens when instinct and analysis arrives at the same conclusion.
I think I've heard that quote maybe 4 or 5 times, similar quote from over my 30-year career in finance from some of the smartest, most sophisticated and best portfolio managers I've ever worked with. The instinct is such a part of what they're doing for investing, but they always back that up with the data and the analysis, like you just said. And it's crazy how you can marry so much of my world with yours, and what an exciting journey that we're both on together with this. Anyway, that was a segue.
Yeah, because in order to be successful in any field, you have to think long-term, right? You have to think long-term and you have to try to build an ecosystem. If you see anything, any opportunities, the ecosystem you're trying, you know, to focus, that's where it can last for generations.
Yeah. What a great point. Can you talk about, as a woman, as an entrepreneur, there must have been so many hurdles that you faced in your career. How did you overcome them? And anything you could share and, you know, for folks that'll be listening in that they could take away and in terms of how you were able to get through that?
Yes, absolutely. The hurdles, the challenge have been real. The biggest hurdle wasn't hostility. It was invisibility. You as a female entrepreneur, the credibility was questioned. In the artistic world, the assumptions was that women only bring emotion, but not structures. So ironically, women often bring both emotional intelligence and the rigorous system thinking. So when you realize that the only way you can do is to show repeatedly that creative ambition and a financial discipline can come from the same woman. And I'm a type of a woman, when I walk in the room, if I don't see my seat, I would build a table. There's a deeper hurdle I have failed and encountered, I would say experienced, was permission. Because as you know, in a male-dominated world, which both in finance and theater, the leadership archetype was not mine, you know, my type. So permission to lead differently and redefine what power looks like That's another hurdle and challenge I've met. But my solution, stop waiting for my information. Build the table or even the room yourself.
Build the table. I like to say wave it in when I talk to clients, but you know, over the course of my career, but you could say relative to, you know, empowerment and women and making sure that you're being recognized, you know, build the table. If the seat's not there, build the table. And I think that's such a great quote that I hope my daughters, you know, certainly take away from this. So
I know we're very good at that.
Exactly.
As you know, right? Half of the females are going to manage and control, you know. No, I'm talking about half the wealth will be managed by female very soon. And the females, women, especially for those who are mothers, we pay attention, some feels that, you know, very differently. And we how we lead are differently too.
That's right. Another good segue, when you think about, I think women in particular, and when you think about your projects, how do you make sure that you're empowering young creative people? I guess that could be women and men in that regard, but within our theme of women, that creativeness, how do you empower that when you think about your projects and the things you're interested in? And you're also deeply involved in the education part of this ecosphere. And so how do you empower and allow them the opportunity to be successful alongside you?
Thank you. I think that's a very important question. And for me, empowerment isn't a slogan. It's an infrastructure. Women, or in general, all, you know, young creatives, they don't just need encouragement. They need access, structure, and a system that believes in them early. So I focus on three things. First, real seats at the table, like we talked earlier. Emerging artists are brought into the creative and the strategic core from the beginning. Authorship, credit, visibility. That's also why I invest in female-funded startups and founded a Broadway Academy, because I really want to emphasize the importance of knowing and understand the business behind the storytelling, not just performance. Another thing I like to do is teaching, like I said, teaching the business, which means that I bring or encourage the creative artists to understand the deal terms, licensing, IP, budgeting, risk. Once those young creatives understand how value is built, they start waiting for permission and start creating their own power. Lastly, like I said, since day one, I established Harmonia. I'm trying to design an ecosystem, not just moments. We're structured as a multi-market, multi-format platform, giving young creatives long-term pathways, not one-off opportunities. So again, I have this very simple philosophy. Empowerment is when someone walks into a room and no longer feels the need to prove they belong. So my job is build those rooms and a global ecosystem that sustains them.
That's great. I love that answer too. Let's move a little bit to one of the more sensitive topics, certainly over the course of the last decade, is the American relationship with the East, Asia and the U.S. relationship. I certainly remember early in my career how easy it was to embrace particularly what was happening in China as an investment opportunity, as an economic opportunity, and how exciting that was. And it's a little disconcerting for me now to see both countries butting heads on so many different issues. You know, for you, you've built this amazing bridge between both cultures, both communities, both countries, the APAC region, as well as the Americas region. And when you think about that, what do you think about historically with the cultural connections and how have you been able to do it? And then I think, you know, more importantly, maybe, are you nervous about what's happening going forward? I'm still very, very bullish as an investment in Asia, but would be fascinated to view your thoughts in that regard as well. So the bridge, the cultural connections, how you've been able to be so successful at it. And then last part of that would be, you know, what's your vision of the future in terms of the two communities?
This is a very timely, important question, Michael. Not just this question has been brought many times in different occasions, not just within my industry, but also among like friends, right? I have family still in China. I still have office in Shanghai. I'm not a politician, right? The reason I choose, there's many career paths I can choose from. The reason why I choose to be focused on storytelling, because I believe culture is a soft power. I think the as intense or complicated the political weather, climate we are, the more important the cultural exchange and the storytelling is. So for me, cross-cultural production begins with respect. You cannot just translate a script. You have to translate emotion. So a story only travels when its emotional DNA is protected. So Western narratives often emphasize individuality, while Asian audience may respond more to collective purpose or family duty. So we don't change the story. We shift its heartbeats so it lands truthfully in each culture. So right.
Do you think about that when you're evaluating a project to make sure
absolutely.
That both of those are being married in the project and that potentially if it was a really individually focused performance or show, maybe that in your mind, you're like, that's probably not going to work in Asia.
Absolutely. So we study local demand, not just like the cost structures, but we also deeply, analysis or audience behavior and the cultural values. So I have a very successful example, which is Jersey Boys. That was 2016. As you know, Jersey Boys is a very typical American stories. There's nobody knows who 14, I'm talking about in China, right? Nobody knew, who Four Seasons is. Nobody believes that's going to work in China. But what I found, there's a common ground, which is the brotherhood, the handshake trust, and also the sacrifice of the family behind all the success, which is so resonate to what happened to China in the last 40 years. Because behind all the fast growth, economic growth, there's so many families sacrifice the missing their kids growing up and also the crave of the trust and the how they do business. So, and also think about how many ordinary people become like billionaire overnight because of the fast growing growth. I saw that we brought this production to China. And we did almost zero marketing, and it was a huge success. So, So talking about the U.S. and China relationship, actually, it's more actually what I've learned and what I've experienced is very different from what the media said, what people heard from like news. There's actually much more demand and hunger for more world-class IP from Broadway or Western to be brought to China.
That's fantastic. That's amazing that the force that resonated. It's very reassuring that these type of enjoyable, culturally fun events that are working very well in the States can also work overseas as well. And in, like you said, there's probably not a lot of music groups that are as American as the Four Seasons, and the fact that that was able to resonate very well in Asia is really, it's actually quite comforting for all of us, I think.
Yeah, I do wish, I do hope, more investors or meet more people to support this mission, which is bring more Broadway level standards into Asia. So it's not just simply exporting the shows to APAC market. So the cultural bridge only works when both sides feel seen. So I think open the storytelling is the great way to connect, to help both culture understand each other even more, much more than political negotiation.
Yeah, for sure. doesn't seem like we're making a lot of progress in that regard. You know, this is something you and I have talked about a bunch, is you're so well known for your success in Broadway. What else is out there for, particularly for musicians and actors and actresses that have had success on Broadway or maybe haven't had as much success as they'd like, that's outside of Broadway? And where do you see, not just with your entrepreneur and your business hat on, but also for some of them, and these creative young people who have this vision of being on Broadway, but that's very challenging and the economic return isn't so great. What else is happening in this ecosystem of theater and entertainment that is potentially things that you're interested in the future, but maybe more importantly for some of these young artists that you're so focused on and care so deeply about that maybe they should start to focus on a little bit more too?
It's very important to understand before you have ambition, right? I think you should build your foundation first, right? I would say in the storytelling field, I think another sector has been has huge, I would say, tremendous opportunities in macro drama, or we call it, macro drama. It has been grow extremely, you know, fast, especially in APEC market. That's one area I would encourage
you. It is a micro drama for those that may not know what it is. I mean, if somebody asked me that the other day and I had kind of a hard time explaining it. It's just little bits and pieces of a show that the audience watches on TikTok or something like that, just in little tiny bits. Is that basically what it is?
Well, it's actually, I think it was, I'm not saying invented, but it started in China, actually. As you know, we all have Gen Z children, right, at home. They have this such short focus or patience on anything, you know, when they come to cultural consumptions, especially entertainment. So the story was designed in a very short time, a length like 60 to 90 seconds. So each episode, then they change with very dramatic, you know, stories and hook the young audience. And probably give you some free episode for up to, I don't know, 5 to 6 episodes when you're really hooked in and it start charging you. So that's kind of the model. And but it works very well. It's grossing, I believe, $6 billion.
Wow.
Yes. So we are
like that in the States at this point?
Yes. Yes.
We do?
Yeah. There's definitely, and we have already built an infrastructure to prepare to get into that sector. Yes.
How about the opportunity for you to touch up on some of the stuff in the high school production area? You know, where that could lead for artists and for folks that are in that area as well. That's more near and dear to me as a father who's got a daughter that's deep in the high school production area.
Oh my gosh. So high school production is probably one of my most favorite productions field, but it's also one of the most underestimated yet most powerful engines in our entire ecosystem.
Wow.
People see it as education, but from an IP and a cultural perspective, it's actually market creation. First, a high school build lifelong audience. When a teenager, like 15, 14, 16-year-old performs or even get involved in a musical production, that title becomes part of their identity. And also the theater community become where they belong. They become future ticket buyers, donors, creators, and parents who pass art on. And secondly, it's a major driver of licensing revenue. In the U.S., high school productions are one of the largest and the most stable licensing markets. And the APAC demand is growing rapidly. Once a show enters the education circuit, revenue can last for decades.
Wow.
Last, not least, the high school globalized the title faster than any marketing campaign. Students rehearse it, share it online, and create a cultural stickiness across generations. So the deeper truth is, high school production are where cultural IP become generation IP. and for Harmonia, that makes them essential to build long-term global value.
First of all, that is new news to me, and I like to think I know a decent amount about the industry. That's just, it's fascinating, but it is. If I think about just my daughter who was in Les Mis, played the role of Fantine, I would have not seen Les Mis on Broadway. No interest. But seeing her and then seeing her colleagues and friends, Les Mis now has another fan. And it's a fan that in a million years you wouldn't have thought would have ever been a fan. And it's because the high school put on such a fabulous job. And your point is this is scalable. It's actually, from a licensing basis, it's an economically fruitful situation too. What a fascinating situation. I had absolutely no idea.
And as a parent, you know, I often tell people, especially my Asian friends, you know, I said, because culturally we were raised to be more like reserved, right? Humble, you know, I said, come on, you know, you got to learn the elevator, you know, what's called the elevator pitch, right? And I said, theater skills are life skills. That's my, you know, I said, if you want to, you have to try to, you know, you have to know how to present yourself. You needed to learn teamwork, right? And also on top of all of this, the high school probably is the most important stage of the lifetime as a human being, right? A lot of worldviews and values. And psychologically, just think about that, right? Your daughter come home and say, hey, dad, I saw a Cinderella, versus one day she came home and said, dad, I am the Cinderella.
Yeah. By the way, that's awesome. Really, really good quote. I'm going to put my finance and investor hat on. And when you think about the life cycle of an investment now, something that you're thinking about from concept to production to potential return, how do you engage investors on this journey with you? And how do you make sure that everybody is aligned on the journey when you think about the economic return of your projects?
I like to call it like life cycle of any arts investment, right? Particularly come to my, you know, at the theater or Broadway. This is how I started. I try to explain to my investor or potential investor that just think about each production as a new startup. It's much like early stage venture capital, except the horizon is measured in generations. I would see there's five phases. The first one I called the spark. Everything starts with emotional truth, right? If the story has a universal heartbeat that can travel across cultures, it moves into evaluation. That comes to, I call it phase two. We call it blueprint. So that's financial architecture, budget modeling, risk curve, global market mapping, and a multi-format potential. If it cannot survive structure, it won't survive the world. So we always get investors with clear cash flow projections, stage-gated capital calls, and recruitment waterfalls. And number third, it's called build. So we build both a creative team and a commercial infrastructure. So, for example, you know, fund composers, screenwriters, director, and we make sure we assemble a creative team that is world-class and also fit in the story we're going to make. And the commercial infrastructure is the key, and we gather the most experienced professions to help the investor understand along the way. Then we called scale. So we launch and scale. There is Broadway and the West End. My dream is someday I'm going to launch in one of the major epic cities, but which I think is not far away. So if you think about it, it's a startup launch, it's like you launch the flagship on Broadway and the West End, and then followed by the tours, and then goes to the global market, especially the APAC market, and local language productions, licensing, concert, you name it. film, TV, and digital assets. So last is long tail. We called, you know, we just mentioned, we just talked about education market, publishing, brand partnerships, and the royalties. So the phase where cultural IP becomes legacy IP. So the real ROI comes from treating a production not as a moment, but as global ecosystem designed to grow over time.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm going to ask the question I think a lot of people are wondering. What are you going to be focused on going forward?
Actually, I have been working on something like I have dreamed for more than a decade. I even have a name for it now. It's called Harmonia Creative 108. It is a global creative studio and an investment platform designed for the next century of cultural storytelling. After years of moving between the artistic world and the financial world, I keep seeing the same gap. Extraordinary creators with the world-changing ideas and investors who want to support a culture but no structure that truly brings them together sustainably. Harmony Creatives is my answer to that problem. So the idea is that the studio where creativity and the discipline live under one roof, a place where artists can imagine boldly, where investors have transparency, governance, and a pathway to long-term value. So the future plans, our plans are very simple and clear. I don't think it's that ambitious. First, we build culture IP as a new asset class. So we develop a skill IP across the theater, concert, all kind of formats, and immersive digital worlds, and brand partnerships. So it's a flywheel model, but applied to global culture. Number two, expand our global ecosystem rooted impact growth. Asia is entering culture consumption boom. So we would deepen our footprint even more in China, Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asia, and the Middle East. So the emerging markets creating a pipeline where stories and talent move between East and West as equal partners. Number three is that we create a creative lamp for new voices. We will incubate original work with world-class collaborators and champion the next generations, especially women, bilingual artists, and culturally hybrid storytellers. So it is not about the show of today. It's about building the creator of tomorrow. Yes, we definitely also integrate AI thoughtfully. AI will not replace artists. It will amplify imaginations. So actually, I learned AI like ChatGPT from my older son, actually. Probably as a proud mom. He's a YC, Y Combinator founders, actually, at age of 19. We will use AI to forecast global markets, protocol, creative concepts, and generate immersive extensions. We build cross-border strategies and streamline development timelines. AI becomes the infrastructure that allows art to travel further and last longer. That's what I see AI. We try to build something that allows families to shape and benefit from the cultural landscape of next century. Finally, we really want to build something that lasts. So my dream is for storytellers to build this platform for storytellers, for global families, and for audiences. To conclude, I'm trying to build this creative lamp that is artist-centered, purpose-driven, and global reach. So the place where East and West meet in harmony. That's my dream.
It's amazing. And I'm sure there are so many people that are going to want to hear and learn more about Harmonia Creative 108. When you're ready to keep telling your story, I'm sure the audience is going to be all ears on that. And it's ironic because what you're speaking of with your vision for the global studio, it's so aligned with many of the private equity managers, hedge fund managers, et cetera, that I speak to in creating this long-lasting brand that is not only creating economic return, but creating a cultural return. In your case, maybe philanthropic and all of that. It's very much the way the investment community, in my mind, seems to be migrating, is that there's more to it than just getting your money back with a return on it. And it seems to me that you're really hitting on a theme that's very important for investors these days.
Thank you. But one thing I have to be a little bit, whatever you call it, cocky, is that, you know, unlike any traditional investment, you know, storytelling investment is much more fun.
Yes.
So look at the smartest family office, right? The, you know, like Niederlander for theater, right? For more power jobs for, you know, film, Jeff, you know, and David Geffen for, you know, classic, you know, music, classic artwork. They see storytelling as both an asset class and a source of cultural influence. I often also share a lot of fun memories with my investors along the way. Like, don't even, you know, of course, you know, the opening nights, the cast parties, global industry festivals, private screenings, creative workshops, all those, and red carpet premieres. There's so many times I got those thank you letters from our investors who said, hey, I'm so proud that me or my family make that happen. So that's the moment I think I call it intangible value. And or I call it emotional ROI.
Emotional ROI. That's one I'm definitely going to have to continue to keep in our tagline as well. So when we view our investors and talk to our investors, it's not only about creating liquidity for them, but it's also about creating this longevity in their investment plan. But maybe most importantly is the legacy. And I think today, what you and I have talked about over the course of the last 20, 30 minutes has been about legacy. And whether you're a Wall Street executive or whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you're an executive in the arts, you know, certainly legacy, I think, is becoming increasingly more important to all of us. And it's just been an honor and a pleasure for me to be able to spend this time with you and develop this friendship and to have you lead my podcast series off in this theme that I just feel is so incredibly important: women's wealth, women's well-being, and this generational transfer of assets that's about to happen. It's an incredible focus, and we're very blessed to be right in the middle of all of this. And Sophie, I want to say thank you. Phenomenal job here on our first podcast. I hope the audience really enjoys this. I know certainly I have. Do you have any parting thoughts before we tune off?
It's always fun. I don't feel like we are doing anything like podcasting or in a recording. I just feel like this is another wonderful, inspiring conversation with my dear friend, especially industry leader like you. And it's such an honor. And I do want to share my experience and my vision. And I myself and Harmonia only can do this much, right? I really want to share this journey with more people, especially I believe the cultural investment is so aligned with the family office mission. There's just natural common ground and the same goals. And so that's probably my hope, my wish.
Thank you very much, Sophie, and happy holidays to everybody. And thank you for listening to our inaugural podcast series of Beyond the Balance Sheet. Mike Pasquale, and I'm signing off. Thank you again, Sophie.
Sophie Chi, bye.
Thank you for joining us on Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale. At Beyond the Balance Sheet, we explore the stories, strategies, and insights shaping the future of wealth, well-being, and legacy. To keep up with our latest conversations, please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend who might enjoy these discussions. If you have any questions, feedback, or topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out to me at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Until next time, keep looking beyond the balance sheet.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.